Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm not a depressive person. I mean, I wouldn't describe myself as perky, but I don't think of myself as a depressive. I sort of fuel myself with mostly rage.
Hello and welcome to the 7th episode of Varvet International with me, your host Christopher Triumph. And my guest today is, well, one of the world's best movie directors, David Fincher. And he and I will talk in just a while, but I'd like to start with presenting this show's sponsor. And today it's a bit humid with about 65% chance of rain, so I'd better wear my Stutterheim raincoat. And one of the amazing things with that coat is that it fits both with a formal look like a suit or with a more relaxed one like a tracksuit. And the quality is fantastic. It's not the cheapest raincoat around, but then again, you merely look after it for future generations. So find your favorite at Stutterheim.com or at one of the 300 stores around the world that carries these garments. Thanks, Stutterheim. Yes, guest today is movie director David Fincher. And if you can't really place him, maybe it helps if I mention some of his work. He directed the fantastic thriller Seven, the instant classic Fight Club. He did Panic Room, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, The Social Network, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which, by the way, mostly is filmed here in Stockholm, Sweden. And now he's here to promote Gone Girl, his new movie that premieres any day. And this movie is based on a huge book with the same name. Well, it was a huge success, the book is, and it's pretty normal in size, I would say. And the movie stars Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike. I just saw it, and it's very interesting in more than one ways. I think it's sort of a comment on America in recess. And it's also very cool that you don't really like any of the characters in a way. I'm not going to spoil it for you, but I just want to mention that the movie's music and sound is made by Trent Reznor from the Nine Inch Nails and Atticus Ross. But David Fincher had a life before he became this super director. He actually started out by doing music videos in the 80s for acts like Michael Jackson, Paula Abdul, Madonna and Rolling Stones, to name a few. We'll get to that also in just a few seconds in this fairly short but focused interview. So, let's roll the tape. Mr. Fincher.
Yeah.
An honor to meet you.
Oh, thank you very much.
Instead of regular sound checks, I tend to ask my guests to describe the setting for us.
Oh, where we are?
Yes, please.
We're in a very beautiful hotel room that has a Nike clog in its in a case.
It's a very Dutch clog. It's not a Swedish one.
They would never go for that kind of flagrant self-promotion.
And we're in Stockholm?
Yep.
Where you are for promotion?
Yeah, for a one-day promotion, but I was actually here for 9 days just riding a bike and going to dinner and wandering around.
Aha, uh-huh, so you've stayed here for like 10 days.
I was here for almost a week and a half.
Okay, how come?
I like it.
Yeah?
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful city. And we somehow managed to be here at the most perfect week. It was, you know, it's just that last time we were here on Dragon Tattoo was you know, 7 days a week, 14 hours a day, and we never got to really enjoy the city. So I came here with my family and we wandered around.
All right. And are they still here?
Yeah. My mother left this morning and my daughter leaves in an hour or so.
All right.
And my wife is back at the hotel.
Okay. I understand. You share background with two of my previous guests in Swedish version of this podcast, Johan Renck and Jonas Åkerlund.
Really?
Yeah. And you guys all sort of started out with music videos.
Yeah, I think I was a little ahead of the... They were the Swedish New Wave. So I was a little more of a sellout whore long before the Swedish New Wave in music videos. But, you know, obviously I know their work and enjoy it and all of it.
Yeah, and you still keep contact with Jonas? Right?
Yeah. Actually both.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Do you have something in common, except for the obvious, in your CV
with the two of them?
Yeah.
No, I think that what they do is, I mean, it's also very different from each other, but no, I think, you know, my world was, or my video commercial world was more informed by sort of the late 70s and not so much. And I also think that, you know, probably the, you know, what I would consider to be sort of the Swedish movement in music videos was a reaction against a lot of the more overt commerciality of the work that we were doing in LA in the early 80s. Because most of it, one of the things that we were kind of, I mean, Propaganda Films, which is a company that I started with three partners who were also directors, Dominic Senna, Greg Gold, and Nigel Dick. Part of the founding principles of it was the notion of sort of commingling. Why is it that if people are spending kind of money that they were spending at that time on music videos, why shouldn't they be like a commercial? That was sort of our look. It was, I don't want to say it was content free, but it was less about the content and more about sort of the packaging and being. And I think that certainly Jonas's work, I remember the Madonna stuff that he was doing was really outre and not about sort of the cosmetic side of things, which was all the more stunning. So I think it was kind of a reaction against what we were doing, and more power to it.
When he moved into feature films and so forth, when I asked him about what he brought from his previous work was, I mean, he talks a lot about rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
I realized yesterday that your new film is sort of rhythmic in a way that it's super effortless. Could you say that?
That may be attributable to the fact that Atticus and Trent, who scored, you know, the last three movies that I've been lucky enough to make, we have a very different working process. It's not so much about deciding what the picture is and then kind of forging sounds that coincide with what's happening in the picture. Oftentimes, you know, I have so much respect for Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross that I would never go to them and say, this is the final picture. Because I always think that they bring something to the atmosphere, to the pace of the world around the characters. And so they will start, I mean, they started writing music really before we had a final cut of the movie. I showed them about 40 minutes when we returned from Missouri. We were in LA, and I showed them about 45 or 50 minutes of the movie, the first sort of assembly. And then they just went off, and then they would just send tracks. I mean, and not like two or three, but like 13. Like you would get an hour's worth of music. And then we would start sort of saying, well, what's your intention here? And they would say, well, we didn't really know, but we feel like this sound has to be part of the landscape. We go, okay, landscape. All right, well, let's move this under the water tower shot, and let's put this over. So it's not like a music video at all. I mean, in a music video, you get the song and you make pictures and you cut those pictures to that. And I've done that with them. We did that on Social Network. We did that with In the Hall of the Mountain King, where I just said to them, you need to take this piece of music and just do your best Wendy Carlos to it. And so they gave us a piece of music and we just cut the pictures to it. But in both Dragon Tattoo, they were sending me music as I was shooting. I would get a little alert on my phone, and, you know, and I would look and there would be, you know, five new files from Trent, and I would plug in my head phones and on the van on the way to Sheila Ford's, and I would play music, and I would be driving up to the house we were shooting in and playing this music and going, that's the music for driving up to the house. And so it's not that it's not an indifferent process, and it's not a sloppy process. But it's very much a process of, I talk to them about what my hopes and aspirations and intentions are, and then they respond, and then they respond musically, and then we take these things and we hone them together. So I'll say, I can actually make the sequence shorter now because you've actually found a rhythm that's much faster than what I had. So I'm going to take this now and squeeze it. I'm going to send it back to you. And then they'll look at it and go, okay, now we feel that there needs to be a transition that happens at this moment. I say, great, show it to me. And it's much more of it's like tennis.
Yeah. An organic process.
Yeah, it is. I think it can only happen in, if you're thinking of music in its very classical use as underscore, I don't think you would go to these guys, because I think that there's so much more than that. They have too much to offer. So I look at what they do sonically as, you know, they construct worlds. That's the thing that I loved about, I've always loved about Nine Inch Nails, was this aural envelope that's so broad and so deep, and you kind of experience it in them. There are very few people who stimulate your imagination, and Trent's one of those people. And so to put a bridle on him and say, you have to follow only these pictures would be counterintuitive.
Who are the other ones?
Well, I think, you know, when you're talking about, you know, I think they're everywhere. They're in CG, they're, you know, commercial makers, there are, you know, the two guys that you mentioned. But there's, you know, I mean, Mark Romanek is a friend and colleague and somebody who I look to, and you know, Garth Davis. There are people out there who are doing things that are above and beyond and beyond the side of the frames, beyond the headset on your head, beyond the MP4 file. You know, they just, it's not just a melody line. It's, you're up to your eyeballs in it.
So what you're saying is that when you work with these people, you have to sort of update the image that you have of the end result.
I start with an idea of the end result. Let me put it in a different way. There's a fallacy in how one designs a motion picture experience. And I think the fallacy is that it's a wind tunnel tested, extremely technical, scientific experiment. And really, that's not the case. There's a lot of technical knowledge and a lot of technical expertise that goes into making a film. But remember, the ultimate takeaway of a film is emotional. You just saw a dream, and it either affected you or it didn't. And you know, as Louis B. Mayer once said, you know, the beauty of the movie business is that the only thing that the buyer gets for their cost of admission is a memory. And so memories are evocative, and they're evocative because they work on an emotional plane. So you can have all the best intentions. You know, you can work backwards from an impeccable blueprint to bring in an audience, hopefully, to this place where they go, oh, I never imagined that was going to happen, or oh my God, that's so funny, or that's the saddest thing I've ever seen. You're working toward that, but they're going to have to meet you halfway. You know, that's the thing you can never plan on. So when you're interfacing with a sound designer like Ren Klaes, or an editor like Kirk Baxter, or a cinematographer like Jeff Cronenweth, you're not talking about people who are measuring things in terms of decibels, or measuring things in terms of foot candles, or measuring things in terms of, you know, feet and frames. You're talking about people who are measuring, they're projecting themselves into an experience and imagining an emotional response. So if that's the intention, then the idea of sitting back and saying, okay, now you know by 18 feet, 6 frames, we have to have a catharsis here. You know, it doesn't make any sense to talk to Trent Reznor that way. You kind of have to say to him, I'm hoping that this is where the other shoe drops. I'm hoping that this is where people begin to go, oh, he's not such a good guy. He might actually be a murderer. You want that. That's the discussion that you're having. The discussion that you're having with all of the people that I'm lucky enough to work with is, what do we want to feel? How do we bring people we've never met to the same place all at the same time? You know, who all come from differing places in their lives and differing places in the world. And we need to get them. You know, I've often talked about this. There's that amazing moment. I remember being 9 years old and seeing a Rear Window and watching Raymond Burr put on a hat and a raincoat and take a giant suitcase out of his apartment in the middle of the night. And everyone in the theater at the exact same moment says, oh, he killed her. He cut her up and put her in the... Now, I was 9 years old. Like, how was that even in my... How was that even in part of my imagination?
And but how did your parents let you watch that?
Well, it was a good thing. I think in the end, I'm extremely grateful to their lapse in judgment. But that's what we're talking about. We're talking about taking people to a place where they get emotionally hit by the same technical presentation. And they feel the same thing in unison.
But the thing is that you seem to be a little bit worried about if people think it's funny enough.
One of the things that was interesting to me was I thought there was a very wry, not sarcastic, maybe sardonic sense of humor to the source material. And I felt that Gillian had a very tongue-in-cheek presentation. And I really wanted to push that. I really felt that that was an important part of seeing this. If you're going to see this kind of terrible behavior... You know, it has to at least have a sense of humor about it. It can't be a... But we have had screenings. You know, I've screened the movie where people laughed, and I've screened the movie where nobody laughed. And you kind of go, as you watch it, it's shocking. And I think it's about, oddly, it's about permission. You know, the movie has to create room. The marketing of the movie, the presentation of the movie has to create room for people to have those feelings, to be able to look at something and go, this is absurd. This is nuts. Why are they in a Doris Day movie? Like, how did this happen? Where did this come from? You know, and that's one of the things, one of the key casting questions in putting the movie together was, who's going to play Desi? Because Desi has to be, he's not of this earth. You know, I likened it to Claire Quilty in Lolita. It's an element of absurdity because, you know, this weird beatnik hipster, poet, journalist, dancer, it's not something that most people can go, oh, like Uncle Clem. You know, there's not a lot of, you don't have those people, most people don't have them in their families or in their lives, have a Peter Sellers hanging around. So I was looking for somebody who was that kind of energy, that had that thing that you just go, whatever he says, if he says I should watch the Tonys, then I should watch the Tonys.
You started filming really, really early on, right? You were like 8 years old or something.
Oh, yeah. Making movies?
Yeah.
Not movies. I mean, I was just a dorky 8-year-old with a Super 8 camera. I didn't really make movies until, I didn't really like... kind of understand Masters and Over the Shoulder and Singles. I didn't really understand that stuff till I was in my teens, but I started playing around with, you know, shooting my sister with blank guns when I was very young, and doing sort of makeup effects and having all of my friends bleed orally and fall down steps. So I did a lot of that sort of goofy, you know, the kind of stuff that kids do when they're left unmonitored.
When I look at your resume, it feels like you've always wanted to do movies.
I mean, when it wasn't an option, it's not like... when I was making music videos, I didn't go to sleep at night weeping and saying I should be making movies. I knew that I was biding my time until somebody would give me an opportunity to, and unfortunately, I jumped at the wrong opportunity. But no, I was... I mean, at the time, it felt like a hellishly long period, you know, from the time I was 22 till I was 28, I was making commercials and music videos, and it seemed like I would never get an opportunity to make a feature film, but it was only 6 years, you know, it's not like I don't have a lot to complain about, it's like, but it did at the time, I felt like I felt when I was making music videos and commercials like I was putting myself through film school. I wasn't doing it with the idea of this will be my legacy. I was doing it as a way of experimenting and playing with techniques and ideas that I was interested in. And, you know, in retrospect, a lot of them weren't that interesting, but some of them were kind of cool and fun. And I look back on that period and you know, with semi sense of nostalgia, there were a lot of things about it that I met a lot of really interesting people. I worked with a lot of really interesting people, and a lot of them I'm still working with today. But truthfully, it was a kind of horrifying day when MTV started putting the directors' names. I was shocked. What? I thought I was doing this. I thought I was able to do this in secret. But I felt about it in a very different way than a lot of my cohorts.
Can you tell me about your first job in the industry?
Yeah, I worked for a local filmmaker in Marin County in San Francisco Bay Area who was a very revered director who had been one of the first people to sort of stake a claim to Northern California and want to make cinema out of Hollywood. And that was John Cordy. John Cordy was partners with George Lucas and Francis Coppola in the first, I believe it was American Zoetrope, the first Zoetrope incarnation. And they had a studio out in Stinson Beach or someplace like that. So growing up in the Bay Area, you know, these were the people that were around. Michael Ritchie was making movies. The Candidate was being filmed in Larkspur, and The Godfather was being filmed in Ross, and THX was being filmed at the Marin Civic Center and in the early BART stations. And so there were a lot of film going on. And John Cordy was one of the people. He did an autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman and Who Are the DeBolts? Why Do They Get 19 Kids? And he'd done some, I think he'd done a couple of studio pictures. I think he did the sequel to Love Story. But he was a guy who was hiring production assistants. And I went to move Xerox machines and take out the trash. And so I worked there for a year, year and a half. And I worked in the dark room. I worked in the doing effects animation and then doing effects photography and then doing storyboards for second unit and then doing second units. So I was sort of like a general factotum. And then I went from there to my roommate at the time was working at Industrial Light and Magic and they were hiring. And I went and got a job working on blue screen, shooting Go Motion, and then left there a couple of years later to direct music videos.
When did you realize that this was what you would like to do?
Direct?
Yeah.
I was 8.
Yeah, you were 8?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So you always knew?
I don't know that you always know. I mean, you certainly always cursed to go, I couldn't really imagine. I can't really imagine doing anything else. I joke about it, but it's really true. I don't have, my parents always told me, make sure you have something to fall back on.
Still?
I don't have anything to fall back on. No, I think they've given up on me ever having a reasonable fallback.
When did they?
Well, my father passed 11 years ago. So before that, so it was probably 15 years ago, they were finally. But again, you know, when you tell your parents that you're directing television commercials, you know, I was convinced that my parents thought I was doing like, come on down to Waterbed Warehouse, you know, it's like, or car dealerships, you know, that's what they thought I was doing. They didn't know, they didn't really understand that when you do commercials for Pepsi and Chanel and Nike, that's not the same thing as doing Waterbed Warehouse commercials.
But you haven't worked with the Nike clogs yet.
I have not. This is the first I'm seeing. And by the way, usually this is how they arrive on the set. You know, there's one prototype shoe that you get to do, like you get to do the product shot with. And it's usually like somebody on a plane from Korea, you know, at the last possible minute showing up with a shoe that won't fit on the athlete's foot. And so that's how it would probably be presented to me. And I would be like pulling my hair out going, why have I done this again? Why did I allow myself to be tricked into this?
some time has passed since then, but could you like recall why it was so alluring to you?
I loved to paint. I loved to draw. I loved comic books. I loved sculpting with clay. I liked taking pictures and working in a dark room. I liked building sets. I liked lighting. There's nothing in the film business except for possibly doing promotional tours that I didn't like to do. You know, my father was a writer, so he was at home a lot to himself, with himself, and I saw the sort of abject horror of somebody facing a blank piece of paper and a typewriter every single morning, and I thought, that is not for me. Like, I need to be around other people. And I like the technical nature of trying to impart, in a lot of cases, very subliminal ideas. I was impressed at a very early age. It was impressed upon me, and I was smitten with the idea that I learned about subliminal imagery, and I learned about, you know, I remember reading, you know, Hitchcock, Truffaut, and reading that, you know, these things that were, seemed like they were something that I was doing, that was a part of me, that I was evoking, was something that was planned by somebody else months in advance. And if I do this and I get cut away to the shot of the knife on the table, then now I've created this anxiety and tension. And I love the idea, the magic trick of that, the low magic of it, you know, getting people to look one way while you do something else to them. I also remember I saw a documentary on network television, and it was about the making of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which was my favorite movie growing up. And I remember watching it and thinking, because I'd always sort of naively thought that movies were shot in real time. Well, this movie, you know, this trip that Butch and Sundance are on, this probably took a month, you know, for them to go to all these places. So they probably shot for a month. You know, that was sort of what I assumed. It never occurred to me the three-ring circus that is the making of a movie. And I remember seeing this documentary and just going, wow. They're shipping horses across country. They're building balsa wood trains and blowing them up. They're hanging out with Catherine Ross. This sounds like a pretty good deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you try anything else?
No. I mean, I did a lot. I mean, again, I worked in a dark room. Swept sound stages.
But it wasn't like you sold.
I was not a lawyer.
Groceries.
I was never. No. But when I was, you know, when I was very young, from the time I was about 13 till 17, you know, I probably worked in 50 restaurants. You know, I lived in a small town in Southern Oregon when I was in high school, and I had so many jobs. You know, I worked as a projectionist at a movie theater to be able to watch movies over and over and over. I worked at a news station, you know, doing ENG, electronic news gathering stuff at the barns burning down and shit like that. And if there's anything that 4 years of being a busboy will teach you, it's you've got to figure out a way to be a director as opposed to a busboy.
Now we're here in a hotel room.
Yep.
And you have like 10 interviews today or something like that.
I think less. I have less interviews than
perhaps
that.
Perhaps 8.
All right, well.
Do you enjoy this part of the movie making as well?
No, not because it's not nice to meet new people and not because it's not nice to talk about things that were, you know, part of your sort of formative way of looking at something that you eventually devoted your life to, but mostly because I feel like oftentimes, you know, this process devolves into this sort of mitigating against misunderstanding. And the fact of the matter is, movies are made to be seen by other people and to be thought of by other people at a certain point in their development and manufacture. It doesn't matter what I think anymore. It doesn't matter what my intentions were. You know, it only matters what's translated, what's transmitted. And so for me to sit here and say, you know, well, it's intended to be this, it really doesn't, you know, it's like, what was the intention for?
You don't like being interviewed at all, or?
I don't enjoy it. No. I mean, I don't like listening to people talk about themselves. I can't imagine that anyone, you know, and so I don't, it's one thing for somebody who's a grand thinker and an amazing intellect and somebody who has great insight.
But you're one of the world's best filmmakers. That's something.
I extremely humbled by your suggesting that. But I think that I've done well with the areas that I've chosen to trod. But I also think that a director's job is to take something that is describing something and then figure out how best to translate that. So it feels weird to be talking about all the things around that because the film either does that or it doesn't. So to me, it feels a little overly hubristic to go, well, it just makes me a little squeamish.
Maybe an idea for the next movie is that you let some people watch it and then the press can interview them.
I like that idea.
About your movie then, these two people, they don't get to work and that sort of makes them depressed and so forth. What happens to you when you don't get to work?
When you don't get to work?
Yeah.
God, I don't know.
Have you been working all along?
Yeah, I've worked a 50 or 60 hour week since I was 14 years old. There was a year-long period when I first moved to Los Angeles where I had tucked away enough savings, I felt, to last me, you know, a year and a half or 2 years of not being able to find work. And I had sort of put out my shingle and said, I'm a director now, and I'm not going to take special effects work, and I'm going to direct television commercials, I'm going to direct music videos, and I have to commit myself to that, and I can't be available to do anything less than that, because if I am perceived of as a guy who wants to be a director but will also, you know, be a visual effects supervisor or matte photography supervisor or do whatever, I'll never get to do what I want to do. And it was a rough 18 months, and I blew through my savings, and I, you know, there was definitely a time where I thought, maybe this isn't going to happen. And that was a period of time where I spent a lot of time at the movies, a lot of time wandering around, a lot of time reading, and a lot of time, you know, sort of formulating what I was interested in, how I could best sort of sell myself.
Were you depressed?
No, I'm not a depressive person. I wouldn't describe myself as perky, but I don't think of myself as a depressive. I'm, you know, I sort of fuel myself with mostly rage, and that's what gets me out of bed. I look at...
For real?
I mean, I'm being slightly facetious, but yeah. No, I can almost always find something to be pissed off about that'll make me go, gotta get to the office and deal with this. What is going on? I am being funny. I've had probably last year around this time, I took 7 weeks off, and my wife and I, we went to London and we sort of fumbled around New York and we escaped for that period of time, basically as we wrapped. No, before we, it was before we went to Missouri to shoot. That was the first time. I mean, I've had like 5 days off, 7 days off, once, twice a year, maybe, but pretty much I haven't really. And you know, as a director, you're always working because I have 5 screenplays I have to read. You know, I'm kind of looking at it to go, all right, one of them is going to be for a TV show, or one of them is a pilot to a TV show, and you're always sort of like trying to kind of keep a hand in finding new material. So you're always busy doing that. Even when I'm in the 7 weeks we took off last year, and that seemed like an eternity for me. But yeah, I'm not complaining. I think it's good to work on.
What do you have planned ahead? I read this something this morning.
Well, I don't normally comment on that stuff.
Okay.
I think that I'm way past devising a remake of a British television show called Utopia. And Gillian Flynn, who wrote Gone Girl, wrote the novel and the script, is writing that right now and has turned in the first hour. And it's so much fun and so exciting. So I'm hoping that'll be next. But, you know, you got to budget it and you got to cast it and you got to... Huge endeavor. It's a very big show.
Are you super rich?
No.
Would you like to recommend something?
Well, you missed out on seeing Nine Inch Nails on the road, so that's over with. I would recommend that. What is this restaurant in the Grand?
It's called Matthias Dahlgren.
Yeah, but with the food bar, is that the one?
Yeah, exactly.
I recommend that.
Yeah, okay. So for all...
But by the way, that should not be news to anyone.
No, well, for my listeners abroad.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Wow, so it was amazing.
Come to Stockholm and eat at Matthias Dahlgren's matbaren, or the food bar.
Yeah.
Who would you like me to interview on Varvet International?
I think you should interview Eric Roth.
Thank you so much for the time.
Okay, sure, no problem.
David Fincher interviewed on Lidmore Hotel in Stockholm, September 2014. And as we spoke about, he did all his Swedish interviews in one day. And I think that we got one of the bigger chunks of that day. So I'm happy about that. And we sort of touched base with a little bit of the early days. His current project, Gone Girl, which is something I think you should go see, especially if you haven't read the book, because it's sort of a really interesting change of perspectives in that movie. I won't spoil it any more than that. And his plans for the future, a little bit anyway. So that's it for today. I want to say thank you to Stutterheim Raincoats. That's stutterheim.com. Don't miss that. I'd like to thank the rest of the crew making this podcast. It's producer Christina Gerling-Biro, editor Lovisa Olsson, and the theme song producer Maria Marcus. And my name is Christopher Triumph. Talk to you in a week. Then I'll be joined by Tig Notaro, the comedian who got cancer and went up on stage on Largo in Los Angeles and talked about that. And that ended up in a really, really great comedy record called Live. And we'll talk about that in a week. Take care. Bye-bye. Hej då.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.